from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. What would happen if the kind of war we see from afar were to happen here in America's Deep South? That's what author and longtime journalist Omar El-Akkad imagines in his new novel, American War, set 50 years in the future. Omar El-Akkad is in studio with us to talk about his novel and how his work as a journalist influences his fiction.
There's nothing here that doesn't have some kind of analog and something that really happened.
Join us for Forum right after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. When you open the pages of Omar El-Akkad's new novel, American War, you're transported a half century into the future, to a world where the effects of climate change and limited natural resources have caused a second civil war and split America in two. Omar El-Akkad had a lot of personal material to draw upon when writing this book. He's a longtime journalist and has covered Guantanamo Bay, the Arab Spring, and the aftermath of Michael Brown's killing in Ferguson, Missouri. And he joins us for this hour in studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you. And let's get right into this here. I mean, this is red and blue states writ large in terms of futurist dystopian novel. And it's a kind of could-it-could-happen-here novel, too. But you've said on a number of occasions you're not a seer. You're not predicting the future. You didn't want to write a future novel.
No, I started the novel in the summer of 2014, and I finished it almost exactly a year later, or at least finished the first draft of the manuscript. And at that point, if you had asked me where we would be right now in the current state of events in America, I would have guessed completely wrong. Certainly, I never intended to write a book about the future, and certainly I never intended to try and predict the future.
So no loopy notions of being a seer here or la-la type of stuff, as people would call it, peering into a crystal ball.
No, I'll happily take any added book sales that come with that designation or take credit for something I don't deserve, but it certainly wasn't my intention.
Well, you've been getting a lot of praise for this book. In fact, comparisons to Philip Roth's Plot Against America and Cormac McCarthy's The Road, which are also dystopian and futuristic novels, this is pretty high territory to be compared to for a debut novel.
And entirely undeserved. Yeah. I'm honored to be listed in that kind of company, but when I was writing this book, I had no agent and no publisher and no expectation that it would see the light of day. So to be included in that sort of company is still incredibly surreal.
Well, it's also incredibly surreal to sort of wade into your narrative here and to get into the world that you create for us, because it is a world about a half century from now. What I think you've done in many ways is said sort of subtextually in the story, it can happen here. You're bringing the Middle East home to America. You know, we've got refugee camps here. We've got terrorism here. Well, we've got terrorism anyway, but, you know, refugee camps which sort of breed terrorism. It's a lot of that juxtaposition of what you've covered in the Middle East to America.
Yeah, I mean, the central trick of the book was to take these conflicts that have defined the world in my lifetime, and these are conflicts in which the U.S. presence has been either indirect or from a great distance, and recast them as something immediate and something close to home. And that was a central conceit. That was what I started out trying to do.
And you also obviously studied the first Civil War. I mean, you went back and did a good deal of research on the Civil War that took place in the 19th century?
I did. It was something that was, of every aspect of the book, that was the part that was newest to me, because I grew up in a part of the world where that's not part of the history curriculum. And so it was a fascinating sort of experience to learn about a time when the country that is known to people of my generation as the most powerful place on earth nearly tore itself apart. It was really fascinating to learn about.
But mainly, as I've been emphasizing, you drew upon your own experience as a journalist. I mean, you were in Guantanamo, and in the novel, you've got a detention camp where rebel soldiers are waterboarded. In fact, torture is pretty graphic here. How'd you get a hold on that?
It was an unpleasant writing job. It was not something that I enjoyed doing. In particular, there's a chapter sort of in the second half of the book that takes place at a detention camp that's pretty obviously modeled on Guantanamo Bay. And the things that take place there are very much modeled on, you know, I don't know what euphemism we're using these days, but something, you know, like enhanced interrogation or whatever they're calling it.
That's what they're calling it.
Yeah. And of everything in the book, almost everything in the book lives as some kind of analogy. And of all the analogies, that's the one that's least couched. It's not in any kind of costume. It's fairly clear what I'm trying to do there. And it was not a pleasant thing to write.
Must not have been pleasant to write also about the effects of climate change, because here you're on, I almost said on firm ground. I mean, you're writing about things sinking like you apparently saw in Louisiana.
Yeah, the United States in the future here, 60 years in the future, has the coastlines have been ravaged. Florida no longer exists. There's been a massive inland exodus. And it was based on something preposterous, like 60 meters of sea level rise or something along those lines. A lot of the book was based on things I'd seen covering climate change in the U.S., most notably the stories I did out of Louisiana, which is one of the most gorgeous places on Earth and is also losing the equivalent of, I believe, about a football field worth of land every hour or so. It's maybe the worst climate change disaster in America, and it gets very little coverage.
And it's not that implausible to think that there could actually be a war here or elsewhere over fossil fuels because of the dwindling supply of them, because of the resources in decline?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the idea of the plausibility of a war over fossil fuels was secondary to the notion that it would be fought over a traditional way of doing things, that there would always be people in this country and everywhere in the world who will stick to the traditional ways of doing things long after the folly of doing those things has been made clear. And so in the book, yeah, the war takes place over fossil fuels, but by the time the Union government institutes a fossil fuel ban, pretty well all of the world has moved on to better, cheaper, more efficient sources of fuel. So it's not even like an issue of necessity anymore. It's just an issue of, well, this is how we do things.
Omar El-Akkad is with us in studio. He's the author of a new novel called American War. We talk about Trump and coal mines here just for a moment.
Sure, why not?
Well, let me ask you to reflect on that.
I was reading a story recently about the number of retail job losses in this country and how it very much dwarfs the entirety of what the coal mining industry could produce in terms of jobs. And again, it comes back to this idea, and I'm certainly not an expert on coal jobs. I'm not an expert on U.S. politics. I'm a novelist, so I'm not an expert on anything, really. But I wonder sometimes if the priorities are a clearer indicator of what somebody thinks and the way they view the world rather than what the outcomes are. I'm not sure if coal jobs are ever coming back. I'm not sure if factory jobs in the part of the country that voted most heavily for Trump are ever coming back. And I genuinely don't know what the plan is or what the strategy is to bring them back if there is one.
It used to be that novelists were considered, you know, fonts of wisdom on all kinds of subjects, but I think those days are probably behind us. But, you know, you've done some really yeoman work here in terms of your journalistic work and so forth. And I think it can't help think reading your book. I want to talk to you about the heroine, as an anti-heroine character who came to you, I know, full form almost. But you're thinking about Syria here and you're thinking about Palestine, aren't you?
I'm thinking about a lot of the conflicts in the Middle East. I'm thinking about the conflict in Afghanistan, which in one form or another is probably older than I am at this point. And fundamentally with Surat Chestnut, I was thinking about the idea of how anybody subjected to enough injustice can become unjust themselves. The central point of the book is that there exists no kind of foreign suffering, that the language of suffering is pretty well universal. And what allows us in this part of the world to believe otherwise is basically the privilege of not having bombs rain down on our heads for a very long time. And so that's, you know, the story of American War is generally Surratt Chestnut's story. It's the story of how this little girl who's endlessly curious, stubborn, defiant, trusting, has those qualities turned against her by the injustices of conflict.
They are indeed turned against her, and that comes across very strongly. But she's also kind of trained by the character Albert Gaines. Let's talk about him. Where did he come from? She came kind of full bloom in your mind. Where did he come from?
Yeah, Albert Gaines is essentially a kind of recruiter or a radicalizer. And he's this sort of charming older man who shows up at the refugee camp where Surratt Chestnut is eventually displaced. And he becomes a mentor of sorts to her. And it's not quite clear what it is he wants from her. And that becomes more clear over time. He's based on some of the people I learned about in research when I was covering the terrorism trials. There was a major terrorism.
This is in Toronto, yeah.
This is in Toronto about 10, 11 years ago. And it was all these kids who were, and some of them were kids, I think some of them were about 16, who were rounded up as part of this. They apparently had this plot to, you know, storm Parliament Hill and behead the Prime Minister and all these grandiose plans. And of course, none of this came to fruition. But I learned about the sort of places where they were radicalized and the sort of techniques that people would use to try and get impressionable or alienated human beings to do very evil things. And Albert Gaines, parts of his personality and parts of what he does are based on some of that.
The book, you know, has uplifting sense of love and suffering and, you know, those kind of motifs. But really, it's a dark book. It's about vengeance, as you suggested, and about the savagery of human beings and about how life can be ruined.
It is. I mean, I'm now – one of the interesting things that happens when you get published is that you have to deal in the present with something that you crafted in the past. And so I'm now 3.5 years removed from the human being who wrote this book. And one of the things – and I've read this book now going on 13 times. I've never read a book 13 times. I've read far better books than the one I've written. I've never read those 13 times. But I'm always sort of given pause by the kind of anger that's in there. And I think I was angry when I wrote it.
You're less angry now? No, I mean, was it cathartic to write? Maybe purge you of some of that anger?
Certainly there was catharsis in creating that world. I think having lived in America now going on 4 years, and I had just started living in America when I wrote this book, even though I don't really think of it as an American book, I had started living in this country when I started writing it. I think I'm angry at different things, or maybe I've learned to handle the anger better, or maybe the anger has been supplanted by doubt. I honestly don't know.
You were born in Egypt, but grew up in Qatar for the most part?
Yeah, I left Egypt when I was 5, and I lived in Qatar for the next 11 years, and then we moved to Canada when I was about 16.
And now are an American citizen?
Permanent resident.
Permanent resident, yeah. This book, you've said on a number of occasions, wouldn't have happened if it weren't for a bad day at work.
So it's my first published novel. It's the fourth novel I've written, but it's the first one that ever left the hard drive. The first three got written, and I didn't think they were very good, so I never tried to do anything with them. And in fact, I finished this one, and it was sitting there alongside the other ones on my hard drive. I'm not a very good judge of my own work, and I don't know. I didn't know, and I still don't know if it was any good. But then one day, I was working as a journalist, and I had a bad day. I had a day where I felt like I wasn't doing the sort of work that I had gotten into the profession to do. And journalism, at its best, you feel like you're changing the world. And journalism, at its worst, is you feel like you're rewriting press releases. And I had a day when I felt like I was rewriting press releases. So I had a phone call with one of my senior editors, and it ended pretty badly. I hung up the phone, and I decided to try my luck and send this off to an agent that I knew from a few years back. And it went from there.
Well, speaking about writing press releases, this is a novel, and this is a novel that has a lot of narrative drive in it. But you've also got political speeches and transcripts of diaries and journalistic accounts as well.
That's right. Between the chapters, these chapters are interspersed with these fake historical documents, oral histories, letters from politicians, so on and so forth. That started as a sort of crutch for me. I wasn't sure that I could tell the story I wanted to tell purely through the narrative. And I was world building. I was trying to create this world, and so I started writing these documents because it allowed me to lean on my experience as a journalist, and it allowed me to keep track of the world I was creating. And it was only later on that I decided to sort of insert them into the book and see how that played out. And I liked the way it looked, so that's how it remained.
You are creating a world here. I mean, when I first started reading about the Bouazizi Empire, I thought to myself, isn't that the name of the guy who set himself on fire in Tunisia? And indeed it is. But also, suddenly, this Muslim Empire and Tunisia are really the strong forces. You've got Mexico annexing the southern part of the United States. I mean, a configuration that really sort of takes the breath away. I mean, think about the moving of the United States Capitol from Washington, D.C. Who would have thought Columbus, Ohio? Where does all these things come from?
A lot of it sounds more creative than it is and gives me more credit than I deserve. The Bouazizi Empire is effectively based on the idea that in the future there are several more Arab Spring protests, and after four failed ones, finally, there's a fifth successful Arab Spring that creates this new North African Middle Eastern empire. And the creation of the Bouazizi Empire is effectively based on the creation of this country. A number of people from different backgrounds gather together to rise up against what they see as tyrannical government. They succeed, and from many different states, they create a single union. That's not a particularly imaginative thing on my part. That was stolen from the creation of this country. In the future world of the novel, Mexico has annexed a large part of the southwest U.S. That's based on old maps of this continent and territory that Mexico once collected. So effectively, a lot of the book is either based on turnaround or this sort of rearrangement of things that have happened.
And so it's a kind of what if. What if this took place? What if that takes place? Which is what fiction is all about.
Yeah, the central point of the story is that, I would hope that readers take from it a defense of nuance and a defense of gray space, the space between us and them, which has been in large part obliterated over the past 16 years. I don't want people by the end of this novel to like the main character or to sympathize with the main character or to apologize for her. All I want is for them to understand how she got to the place where she got to.
And that understanding brings what with it in your mind?
A sense that we can't out-violence our way out of a problem, I would hope. I'm not sure that anything particularly bad ever comes from empathy. And I'm not an outright pacifist, and I'm, you know, that's not the place I come from. I simply think it's a sort of abdication of moral duty to assume that people who are not like us are somehow beholden to this exotic and unique form of suffering or behave in fundamentally different ways. I don't think that's true.
You could read this novel, though, as an anti-war novel.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. In fact, that's frankly, I didn't necessarily think you were a pacifist, but it really certainly is condemnatory toward war.
Yeah, I think that's accurate.
And especially the carnage and the horrors of war. There's also a feeling that you come away with about, and I think this is pretty much maybe what your intention was. It's always dangerous to ask authors what their intentions are, but that you wanted to, at the core of this, you wanted to say something about the inhumanity that needs to be sort of taken out of the dark and finding empathy, finding humanity.
Yeah. I mean, the further we're removed from what war actually entails, the easier it is to agree to these things. I mean, there's nothing quite as bloody and pointless as an unnecessary war. And it shouldn't be the case that we find out how unnecessary our wars are years after the fact, when people are coming home broken and when entire regions have been essentially sent backwards in time, which is what it means to be on the losing end of a war. You look at pictures of Kabul from the 50s and 60s, and it looks like a place that is futuristic relative to where to where most of Afghanistan is today.
Used to be compared to the Stone Age. Remember, we're going to bomb the Afghans into the Stone Age, but they're already there, those kinds of quips.
Yeah, I remember distinctly driving around. We were in Kandahar province, and we were driving around, and a soldier pointed to what were effectively mud huts on the side of the road and said something to the effect of, I wouldn't be surprised to see Jesus walk out of one of those places. There was a sense that we had moved backwards in time. But this is what happens when you lose a war. And in fact, in the novel, you know, the South, it takes place mostly in the South, which is on the losing end of the Civil War. And it takes place 60 years from now, but there's not much in the way of futuristic technology in this book. Nobody's walking around with tablets and smartphones and that sort of thing. Because that was the experience I had from going to these places, is you move backwards in time when you lose wars.
On the other hand, we may be on the brink of something with North Korea, and that has to do with technology and advancing missiles and so forth. But it's the same kind of notion of, what do you do to withdraw it? What do you do to reconcile or to find a way toward peace? You say at one point you fight war with guns, you fight the peace with stories.
Yeah, I was when I wrote that line, I had recently come back from a trip to the South. I was doing stories on climate change in southern Florida, and then I drove up into Georgia to do a story on a place named Kennesaw, which is a town that has a symbolic law in the books that says every household needs to own a gun. Completely unenforceable, you know, it's completely symbolic, but I was going up to do a story on that. And one of the things you see when you drive up the highway past through the sort of Florida-Georgia line is you see this billboard right when you cross into Georgia. And it's this big billboard on the side of the road, and it says secede. It doesn't say check out this website. It doesn't say nothing more, just secede. And I was fascinated by this idea that the stories from a war that had been fought so long ago still sort of existed and still chugged along. And that, to me, is a really sort of interesting thing.
Well, it was a kind of inspiration for you, although people in California are talking about seceding, too, because they feel, you know, that the Trump administration is so different than what we have here under Governor Brown and so forth. Mm-hmm. We're talking with Omar El-Akkad, and his book is called American War. It's a novel, and he'll be at City Lights in San Francisco this evening at 7 p.m. He's also a recipient of the National Newspaper Award for Investigative Reporting for the coverage he did of the Toronto 18, which we alluded to, the terrorism arrests. And in his 10 years as a reporter, he's covered the war in Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay trials, the Arab Spring revolutions, and protests in Ferguson, Missouri. And kudos to him for sitting down and writing a novel, it's a big challenge these days, but this one is getting a good deal of attention, and we can bring you into the conversation. In fact, let me invite you to join us. Lots to talk about here, and maybe think about in terms of, not necessarily a war between the states, but war in general and the inhumanity of war. I'd like to hear your thoughts and hear your reflections, and you can join us toll-free. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. A second civil war over climate change and natural resources? What do you think? Toll free. Join us at 866-733-6786, and let's talk about the future and what may be in store for us. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, but we do welcome your questions and comments, and we can certainly talk about many of the things that are in the novel. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Omar El-Akkad, journalist, novelist, and he'll be speaking tonight at City Lights in San Francisco at 7 p.m. Lots to think about with this novel and lots to converse about, and we do welcome your involvement in it. In fact, just talking a little bit off mic about dystopian novels, and I think our guest has read most of them, and probably many of you have read some of them. I mentioned earlier Cormac McCarthy and Philip Roth, but there's also David Mitchell's and Margaret Atwood's and certainly a number of others that we could think about. And you may want to comment about dystopian novels, but really talking about a dystopian vision that he lays out in his novel of a second civil war over climate change and natural resources. And also there's a plague in them. It's like Job we're talking about almost. But talk about what you envision with the plague.
So in the novel, one of the states that is most opposed to the Union is South Carolina. And in a very misguided attempt to sort of pacify that resistance, the Union unleashes what it initially thinks is a sort of temporary pacifying agent that turns out to be a full-on sort of plague. And so in the novel, South Carolina has effectively been quarantined as a state. It's been walled off. Part of the reasoning behind that particular conceit was this idea of how easily in wartime strategies get away from you. And so in the book, for example, there are drones. They're called the birds, and they sort of fly around. And they're very similar to the drones that are flying around much of the world today, except that the Union government has lost control of them. Somebody burned the server farm to the ground, and now these things just fly around randomly and drop bombs at random. And I was trying to get at this idea of how surgically people think their strategies are going to work in wartime and how very rarely that is the case.
Let me bring some of our callers aboard here, and let's begin with Rahim. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. How you guys doing today? Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you.
Okay, great. Well, Omar, I want to say thank you for such a beautiful book. This is going to be a two-part, very thorough question, so bear with me, please. My first question is, how does your identity play into the fact that you're writing a story pretty much about how your own nations, your home nations, have kind of developed because of the colonizing nation America is? So America is kind of reflecting what the Middle East has become today, and that's what you're reflecting in your novel. My second question is, you mentioned how, you know, you don't have an agent, you don't have a publisher, and now as a champion for, you know, for almost kind of being the voice of, you know, this new age, how do you feeling the pressures when, you know, as an author and a writer, to write about issues like Palestine and BDS without feeling the pressures of people kind of to suppress your voice?
Two pretty big questions. Let's take the first one first. How do you feel about U.S. culpability? I mean, did that infuse itself into your novel?
So firstly, thank you, Rahim, for that. Thank you for your kind words and for the questions. In terms of the idea of U.S. culpability, I don't subscribe to the notion that states need to have a fully altruistic foreign policy. America is free to do whatever it wants in that respect. What I do have a problem with is this notion that people who exist outside of the American circle are somehow exotic and unique and lesser.
It's Edward Said.
Yeah. Certainly not. I'm not nearly as eloquent on the subject as he was, but that notion certainly comes into play. In terms of what Rahim said about my own identity, the book is grounded in a sense of unbelonging, in part because I have that sense. I was born in one place, I grew up in another, I became an adult in a third, and now I live in a fourth. And I am constantly sort of wrestling with this notion of not knowing where I belong and in what sort of stories I can take comfort, stories are.
I'm sorry, but what's coming to mind immediately is somebody like Rushdie who says it's that feeling of not having a homeland or not having a clear identity or being almost an alien all the time.
Yeah, which sort of brings me to the notion of Rahim's second question, which is a perfectly valid one, but first off is based on the premise that I speak for anyone, which I don't. I'm certainly not not in that kind of leadership capacity. I am simply a proponent of the idea that there should be no subjects about which we are afraid to speak. He brought up the idea of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. I fully believe that most, at least federal politicians in this country, do not care less about Israel or Palestine, that they would much rather not have to deal with this issue at all. But in lieu of that, we'll do whatever is politically expedient at the time. I'm simply a proponent of speaking about things. I think silence is a inalienable personal right, but I'm very much opposed to it when it's imposed from without.
But when you have a name like Omar El-Akkad, I mean, you don't your appearance could be, you know, you could be from anywhere, but, you know, you have that name and people do put the identity on you of being Arabic or being Muslim or whatever, with all the Islamophobia that's out there. And I mean, how does that affect a public person? And because now you're, you know, you've got a novel, you're a public person.
Yeah, absolutely. And I still wrestle with the idea of how much of me should be public and what to project in that sense.
But aren't people making assumptions about you that don't necessarily even equate with who you are or what you are?
Oh, I mean, people make assumptions about me all the time. I have a kind of universal skin color, for example. When I'm in the Southwest, I'm mistaken for Mexican all of the time. When I was in Afghanistan, I passed as being Afghanistani. I have an accent that allows me to call you on the phone and tell you my name is Joe Smith, and you know, chances are you might believe me. But that's what I mean by the sense that I'm not sure where I belong. And I know that I've been Arab all my life. I know that I've been Muslim, even though, you know, not particularly devout Muslim, pretty well all my life. I didn't really know that I was brown until I came to this part of the world. That entails a set of assumptions that I never had to deal with before.
And differentness.
Yeah. I don't mind being different. I mind the idea that I have some kind of collective obligation. I am not smart enough or eloquent enough or well-informed enough to represent any group of people. And so this idea that I, you know, what I do speaks for any kind of collective group is very much new to me.
I'm struck by your humility, by the way, and self-effacement. I have to tell you, too, just for the sake of a moment's levity, that I had a friend in high school named Joe Smith, and we were stopped once by the police, and they asked him his name, and he said, Joe Smith. They didn't believe him. Let me go to more calls here, and let's go to Santa Clara and welcome Dan. Dan, you're on.
Hey, I want to say to your guest that you belong right here, my Muslim brother. As an American Jew, let me say that. Let me tell you why I say that. The guys, some of the big names, of course, over at Fox News who are anti-immigrant and going on and on about Mexicans and Muslims and all that, they got names like O'Reilly and Goldberg. So my prediction is in 80 years from now, people with the name of like Saeed and Garcia are going to be complaining about the next group of Americans coming in. That's what our country's always been doing. So I think the Civil War is a great analogy to use because it is about whether this is a country for whites or not, Christian whites. And we've been fighting that battle for a long time, and we'll continue to fight it. And I think we're winning because when you look at the data, the youngins all across this country just don't seem to care about the browning of this country, and rightfully so. That's not what this country is about. It's about, as it says, in our founding documents, and the Civil War finished that. And violence is down. It's nothing compared to when I was a baby in the 60s, which was nothing compared to what was going on in the 20s. So I'm very optimistic about it. I'm very glad you wrote this book, and I'd love to hear more from you.
Well, thank you, Dan. Good to hear that kind of optimism. Do you know Richard Rodriguez's book, Brown, by any chance?
I don't.
Yeah. Well worth reading, where he takes that whole color and expands with his expansive and brilliant mind on it. Let me read some comments. Todd writes, from my recent visit to Pensacola, Florida, seeing the prevalence of high water flooding the city and pickup trucks with the Confederate flag, I got a sense of a place under occupation since the first Civil War and still throwing stones at their federal occupiers. I think this author is tapping into something very real here. Another comment, a listener writes, for centuries, wealth and prosperity has been and still is based upon racism, environmental abuse, and exploitation of cheap labor. It is almost a given. And here's Lisa, who says, my daughter reminded me that the Civil War in the United States lasted 5 years and killed over 600,000 people. War is absurd. Question from Brian. This sounds like it would make a great film. When's the movie coming out?
I found out that my book was on Amazon when I got a note from a scout at a movie studio asking about the film rights. We have been very fortunate to receive some inquiries. We haven't sold the film or TV rights. The only thing I've asked for when people make those sort of requests is that that it not be toned down, that they take it as it is, that I don't, you know, turn on the TV 5 years from now and see American Peace. I wanted it to keep its claws. I don't know if it's a good book, but I thought it was a dangerous one, and I wanted to keep that. But no film or TV deals as of yet.
Anybody as Sarah in your mind? Do you see any particular young actress? Or they say actor now. And...
No, these are not questions that I ever considered until very, very recently. My only hope is that it's, I want to see new faces. I always want to see new faces. I want to see people who'll take this and make it their own.
Again, if you've just joined us, we're talking to Omar El-Akkam, and he's here with us in studio, and we do welcome your involvement in the program. Omar El-Akkad will be at City Lights this evening at 7 o'clock, and he's a recipient of the National Newspaper Award for Investigative Reporting, covered Toronto 18 terrorism arrests and the war in Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay and also the protests in Ferguson. How did that come into your imagination in this novel? Because I think it's there.
There were two ways. Thematically and sort of in a more abstract emotional sense. So I've been a journalist for 10 years. I've been tear gassed on assignment twice in my life. Once when I was covering the Arab Spring in Cairo, and the other time when I was covering the Black Lives Matter movement in Ferguson. And that's not to say at all that understanding one of these situations somehow implies an understanding of the other. I was simply struck by how the visual language of those two places had a lot of similarities. Tanks on the street, you know, militarized presence. This kind of ridiculous false equivalency of things like the destruction of lives somehow being equivalent to the destruction of property, as though those were two equal and offsetting events somehow. The other way it played a role was when I started writing this book was also the same time that I started living in this country, and I was just beginning to understand the extent to which race and racism shapes so much of what happens here. And I was struck by the idea and the repercussions of what happens when the basic act of wanting to be treated like a human being is somehow treated as being a radical act. And that sort of shaped my thinking when I was writing the novel.
Again, we invite you to join this conversation with any questions or comments. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email forum at kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at kqedforum, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Here's Shaheen from Palo Alto. Shaheen, welcome.
Thank you, dear. Good morning, and thank you so much for a great program. And I would like to really appreciate and thank your guest. And, you know, the best war, I think this is the best war he's fighting, just increasing the awareness. I have a question for him. Just I wanted to know what was his intake or emotion when he saw on TV that President Sisi from Egypt met with President Trump and just, you know, important issues with, you know, they decided to talk in private. Just I want to know that.
Well, you've already cast yourself, Omar, a little bit non-politically, but did you have any reaction to that meeting between El-Sisi and Trump?
It was interesting for me because one of the ways in which I try to not so much predict but try to anticipate what's coming next right now is to look at places like Egypt under Sisi, which is to say that the election of Sisi in Egypt came after a moment of great sort of democratic fervor and this kind of optimism. But it eventually boiled down to the big, strong man saying he was going to do the bad things to the bad people and people believing him, and only after the fact realizing that his definition of the bad people was much more broad than anybody anticipated. I'm always worried when people like that are praised in this part of the world. It's never a harbinger of good things. So I was somewhat perplexed and alarmed, but not particularly surprised to see him come here and get the greeting that he did.
The argument, though, and I wonder what your response is to this, because, you know, you have a wide-ranging imagination about these things and obviously have a great deal of stake intellectually in the Middle East, is that, and you've heard this argument before, that someone like Mubarak or al-Sisi, strong men, yes, dictators, oppressive against so many human rights and freedoms and so forth, but stability, security. And the Muslim Brotherhood, on the other hand, had a democratic elected president of Egypt. There was the fear that, you know, it would bring on chaos and would bring on even worse kinds of consequences. So there's always that argument. How do you respond?
It's a perfectly valid argument. The first free elections in modern Egyptian history resulted in the election of a Muslim Brotherhood-aligned, largely incompetent president. I am no fan of the Muslim Brotherhood, not by any stretch of the imagination. I'm just curious about what the end result is when we constantly list for ourselves as a benchmark the lowest possible, the lowest common denominator. As long as we are slightly better than the worst possible thing, we are somehow doing okay. I don't think that anybody in this part of the world or in any part of the world would be okay with the idea of having terrible, corrupt, authoritarian governance simply because it is slightly better than outright chaos. That's not a fair thing to impose on any people. And so when I hear these things about, well, you know, Al-Assad is bad, but ISIS, or Sisi is bad, but the Muslim Brotherhood, sure. But is that really the level that we're going to hold ourselves to? That seems borderline pathetic.
Do you think, since you spent years in Qatar, that countries like Qatar and Gulf region countries should be taking in Syrian refugees? Because they're not. I don't believe they are, at any rate.
I think given the extreme amount of wealth in these countries, particularly in the Arabian Gulf countries like Qatar, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, what protects them from a lot of the sort of chaotic nature of the rest of the Middle East is a wealth born of largely of natural resources. But with that kind of immense wealth comes an obligation. And yes, I mean, the short answer to your question is yes, absolutely. I think on virtually every humanitarian issue in the Middle East, the Gulf countries could be doing and should be doing a lot more.
A tweet from a listener named Zuha says, enjoying this so much. Thanks, Omar Al-Akkad, for speaking about your book and your personal experiences as a brown Arab Muslim in America. Let me bring another caller on from Alameda. Toon, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. I am a product of refugee parents who fled from China to Burma during the Japanese invasion of China. And then we left Burma during the period of riots and ethnic cleansing in 1969 to San Francisco. Do you think there is a phenomenon, which I'm obsessed with, no formal declaration of war, no heavy machinery, yet there is millions, tens of millions of casualties and bloodletting on both sides due to ethnic partitions. I'm thinking in particular about the 1947 ethnic partition of India, where I believe, I'm not sure, about 3 million Hindus and Muslims perished, mostly hacking each other to death with machetes and small pockets of attacks of shrines and temples. And also I'm thinking about the Rwanda genocide, where basically both sides, the Hutus and the Tutsis, hacked each other to death with low-level machetes. Is that something that's emblematic of just the 19th century, or do you see potentials of it, hints of it in Syria, and I'm thinking of Egypt eventually, of this kind of phenomenon continuing?
I guess he's, the real import I take in your question, Toon, is the kind of really barbaric things you saw in Rwanda or you see, you know, in so many different parts of the world, universal, perhaps.
Yeah, my knowledge of the partition of India and the Rwandan genocide is purely from reading and research, and I'm not nearly qualified enough to speak on them. My sense of what has changed in war, at least during my lifetime, has to do with the idea of two major changes. that maybe aren't changes at all. Maybe this has always been this way and I've just sort of come around to seeing it this way. But the idea of a traditional war largely fading into the background, the idea of a formal declaration of war followed by two well-established uniformed armies in combat is not something that has defined the wars of my lifetime. And in fact, most of the wars of my lifetime in one way or another can be referred to either as illegal or irregular. But the other change has had to do with distance. You know, there was a very real change in this country during the Vietnam War when you saw images of what that war entailed. That had a very real effect on how conflict was perceived. And now we move into almost the other end of the spectrum, where war is a very distant thing, and you see these blurry, almost video game type footage of bombs dropped on people, and it looks very similar to what you would see if you were just playing Call of Duty or something.
To a degree, I mean, the child fleeing from napalm, for example, in Vietnam had an extraordinary dramatic effect, but so apparently on Donald Trump did the videos from Syria. I mean, there's still people who can get things on video or get things that really show, you know, kind of the horror. Joseph Conrad. And that's what I was thinking with this last call, that so often, and I get this feeling from reading your novel too, the other becomes not a human being, just something that has to be destroyed by whatever means necessary. And those means become sometimes more and more horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Right. When you think about Rwanda, for example, and the machetes that the caller listened mentioned, I mean, let me thank the caller for that. Here's Ray, who writes, Mr. Alucard is right on. The real dangers of climate change are social inertia, the American way of life meme. We've touched on a lot of your work as a war correspondent in Afghanistan and seeing sinking lands in Louisiana and going to Ferguson. I mean, been, you know, certainly exposed to a great deal as a journalist. What about those sewers under Las Vegas?
So this was a story that to give you some background, I was for a while at the Globe and Mail, which is the Canadian newspaper I worked at. I was the technology reporter, and that entailed going to an event called CES, Consumer Electronics Show, in Las Vegas. Once a year, around January, we would go, and it's the biggest sort of electronics show in the country. It is a terrible waste of time. I don't recommend anybody go. But I had to because I was a tech reporter. And one year I was there and I felt that there was very little journalism to be done at the actual show. So I chased down what I'd heard that there were hundreds of people who live in the sewers and drainage ditches underneath Las Vegas. So there's miles and miles of drainage ditches under Las Vegas, under the Strip. And because that's a particular jurisdiction where homelessness is treated with a kind of cruelty, people took refuge underneath the ground. And so you'd be walking through, you know, Caesar's Palace or something, and underneath you, there are people living in the drainage ditches. And so I went down there and I did a story, and it still remains the only decent story I've ever done from my CES trips.
You know, you were kind of forswearing the idea of being futuristic or peering into the crystal ball. But, you know, there was one thing you were particularly prescient about, which perhaps you know now because I'm sure it's been brought to your attention, foreign countries meddling in U.S. politics.
So in the book, effectively there's an agent of the Bouazizi Empire who shows up in America, and his job is he's a saboteur. His job is to prolong the conflict as much as he can so that the other empire can get a leg up. And when I first wrote that, I didn't predict anything that was happening right
now.
None
of the Russia stuff was going on, right?
No, not at all. I based it on U.S. involvement in the Soviet conflict in Afghanistan in the 80s, which was the idea that the rival empire was caught in a quagmire halfway around the world, and anything you could do to prolong that was beneficial to your own empire. That's what I based it on. I certainly never predicted that we would have alleged Russian influence in a U.S. election. That's far more science fiction than anything I could write.
Spending the hour with Omar Alucard. Again, he'll be at City Lights in San Francisco this evening at 7 o'clock. His novel is called American War. And I was interested to also read that we've been talking about all these dystopian novels, and I know you've read them all, Handmaid's Tale and the road and so forth. But I think at one point somebody asked you the two most influential writers, and you picked, well, two of my leading writers in my pantheon, Toni Morrison and William Faulkner.
Yeah, a lot of my favorite writers come from this country. And I am, you know, I think Toni Morrison is the greatest writer alive. I fell in love with Faulkner when I first got my hands on, I believe it was As I Lay Dying, was the first Faulkner I read.
Which he wrote in about 6 weeks, I believe.
Yeah.
I mean, that's so incredible.
All these writers are of such talent that it's depressing. And it's, you look up and think, these are constellations I'm never going to reach. But yes, I've been a
You're still a young guy, fan. Omar. There's a future ahead. Yeah.
Yes, but I'm a big fan of those two.
Well, and many fans of your book, I count myself among them. Thank you for this novel and good luck to you and press onward. What are you working on now?
I'm working on another story. I'm only about 50 pages in. I have no idea where it's going, but that's my life right now.
Well, that's the fun of it, isn't it? Something's ignited and you don't know where it's going. But you'll find out, I hope. Thank you again for being with us. And again, Omar El-Akkad's book is American War. He'll be at City Lights this evening at 7 o'clock p.m. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum's producers are Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Susan Britton, Jeremy Siegel, and Judy Campbell. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Interns are Devin Holt and Stephanie Roberts. Executive producer is Holly Kernan. And please join us for a special broadcast from Contra Costa College in San Pablo on April 26th. It's part of our Forum on the Road series. For more information and to join our live audience, visit kqed.org/forum. That's kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.